Hi friends, this is Brock Polk, and I want to thank you for downloading this sermon from Heritage Church of Christ in Fort Worth, Texas. Our mission is to lead others to a thriving relationship with Jesus, and if you're ready to take a next step in your faith journey after you listen to this message, you can contact us through our website at www.heritagechurchofchrist.org. God bless you, and I hope you enjoy the following message.
Well, it is awesome to be here with you this morning. Hey, well, welcome back. Thrilled to be able to share this time with you. But is there anybody else in the room really having a hard time coping with the fact that it's July 29th already? I mean, wow. Yeah, everybody who has to go back to school, raise their hand. And I get it. Seems like just a couple of days ago, we were celebrating Memorial Day and the graduating seniors and all of the end of school festivities and all of that kind of stuff that was happening. And then sometime this week, we bought school supplies at my house because we're getting ready for a new school year that's starting. And I see some of the teachers in the room who you have that look, you know, because you're about to be back to reality. And I know. But as the summer winds to a close, my family has been doing something fun. We're keeping an eye on our summer fun list to make sure that we got everything done that we wanted to accomplish. We have this tradition every year at the beginning of the summer, make a list together of all of the fun things that we want to do. Some of them are big, like we want to go visit great grandma, and some of them are we want to go get snow cones, you know, like little things like that. But we tried to check everything off the list, and we have one more movie to go to finish the original Star Wars trilogy, and then we'll be done with the list, you know. And so I hope that your summer fun list, you got a chance to knock some things off that list as well. But all of the fun activities, of course, have to happen in the midst of all of the other to-do items, right? Like, you know, you still have to go to work unless you're off work for the summer. You still have other things that you've got to get done. There's always something that's got to be maintained. It's got to be repaired. It's got to be updated. It's got to be renewed. And I could bore you with my summer to-do list, like the lawnmower maintenance and the sprinkler system repair. But the fact is, you've got your own list, right? Like, you know all about this. You know what that feels like. If you own a car, you know that it seems like every few minutes that thing is dinging on the dashboard and telling you it's time for maintenance, it's time for new tires, it's time for whatever, you know. Or if you own a house, it feels like, boy, we just got done cleaning the flower beds and this needs to be done again. Or there's some new project, something needs to be painted, or the air conditioning filter needs to be replaced, or whatever. The list goes on and on. And it just gets exponentially more complicated if you have an RV, if you have a boat, if you have a second home, or if you just have a job, or if you just have kids, or if you just like have other people that you're around in your life. Life is so incredibly busy, and I know you know that, but one of the life lessons that I'm learning, and I bet you're noticing too, is that the more stuff you have, the more stuff you have to take care of. All right? And that's an important realization. The more stuff you have, the more stuff you have to take care of. Now, there was a book that came out in the U.S. about 4 years ago. It made the New York Times bestseller list. Some of you may be familiar with it. It was called The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up. Anybody aware of this book? Marie Kondo. All right, not a lot of readers in the room. That's okay. No problem. No, I'm just kidding. This was a bestseller book, and Marie Kondo is a Japanese woman who has this system for decluttering your house and decluttering your life in order to experience more peace and joy. And her decluttering tactics are extreme. Okay, here's how it works. If you have Marie Kondo come to your house as a consultant, here's what she'll make you do. You have to get every piece of clothing you own and get it out and put it on the bed, all right? And one by one, you're going to pick up each piece of clothing and you're going to ask yourself, does this piece of clothing bring me joy? And if the answer is no, it has to go. All right? If the answer is not a resounding yes, I love wearing this, then it has to go. And that's pretty extreme. And then she makes you do that with your books, and she makes you do that with your nostalgic things. She makes you do that with everything in your house. And you may not be interested in going through your closets and your drawers that ruthlessly. You may not be interested in going through that kind of an intense decluttering process. But Marie Kondo's method does make you consider one thought-provoking reality, and that we need to all think about, and that is this. You have a relationship with every single thing that you own. Is that not true? You have a relationship with everything that belongs to you. Everything you have occupies some combination of your space and your time and your thoughts and your attention and your resources, right? I mean, everything you own takes up space in your life. You have to think about it from time to time. You have to rearrange it from time to time. You got to change the oil in it, whatever it is, everything you own. To put it a different way, everything you own owns a little piece of you, right? Everything you own has part of your attention, time, resource, space, all of that kind of stuff. And I don't know about you, but I have owned some ridiculous things in the past. I have allowed some pretty ridiculous items to own a little piece of me. Before we get into all of that, we've been making our way through our summer message series the last few weeks here, and the series is called Summer on the Mount, and it's been a journey through Jesus's most famous single teaching episode. He was addressing a crowd full of people who had become attracted to his ministry and his message, and we call this one teaching episode the Sermon on the Mount. And in this message, Jesus lays out this grand vision for what it looks like to live your life in response to God, living your life in response to God's generosity, God's will, God's call, God's gift, God's invitation. The whole point is, this is what it looks like to live in response to who God is and what God's done. And what we've learned so far in this series is Jesus is inviting his followers to a life that is extremely uncommon and extremely unnatural. In fact, it's unpopular. All right. He is calling us to a life, for example, this is what we've talked about already. He's calling us to a life where we speak truthfully all the time. In my world, that's uncommon. That seems unusual to me. He's inviting us to a life where when we're angry with somebody, we don't just stew on that and figure out about how we're going to get back at them. Instead, we figure out how we're going to reconcile with them. And in my life, that's not natural. He's inviting us to a life where we don't seek revenge. And a few other things that we've studied in these last 6 weeks. And if all of these don't sound to you like earth-shaking instructions, then you're not paying very close attention. Because the Sermon on the Mount describes behaviors that none of us have mastered. None of us have accomplished this. None of us have arrived at this point. But if you think that 4 weeks ago when we talked about anger that Jesus was hitting a little close to home, or if you think that a couple of weeks ago when my friend Mike spoke and talked about Jesus' message to love our enemies and pray for those who persecute us, if you think that seemed like Jesus was kind of reading your mail a little bit, watch out, because today's passage is going to hit all of us right here between the eyes. I mean, it just deals with every single one of us. We're reading from this ancient document. I mean, nearly 2,000 years ago this happened. We're reading from this ancient document that has so much modern relevance and application. And I think that's one of the best arguments for how relevant this faith really is. You see, on that day when Jesus was sitting on that mountain talking to these people, he was not just describing issues that they dealt with in that time. He wasn't just talking to people who lived in the ancient Near East. He wasn't just talking to people who lived under Roman occupation. He wasn't just talking to a particular socioeconomic group or a particular nationality. He wasn't talking to just some specific. He was talking about the problems that the entire human race deals with. Every single human deals with anger. Every human deals with lust in their life. Every human is tempted to be dishonest. And Jesus is talking to all of us. He's talking to you and he's talking to me. In fact, for generations, every Christian church, every Christian group throughout the last 2,000 years has held up the Sermon on the Mount kind of like a mirror and said, wow, Jesus is calling us to something that's different, to a plan that's different than the life that I had planned for myself. And that's going to be true again in the passage that we're looking at this morning. Jesus is talking about the stuff that we own. And as he talks about that, he addresses this false underlying narrative that all of us at some point or another have believed in our lives. And that the narrative that we have believed is that stuff can make us happy. You've been there, right? You've been through the cycle. I've been through this cycle dozens, maybe hundreds of times in my life. You make a purchase or you beg for a gift, and because you've found the perfect item. You found the thing that you've been looking for. It's got all of the features. It looks like what you wanted. It's the right color. It's got the right bells and whistles, all of that. You have wanted this thing forever. Maybe it's a pair of shoes that fit just right. Maybe it was the newest cell phone or a video game system, or it was a piece of furniture, or maybe it was a house. Maybe you finally found just the right house, and it was laid out just like you wanted it, and it was in the right school district, and it had all the features that you wanted, and you couldn't wait to have that, whatever it was. We live in a marketing saturated environment that is designed to make us feel like we always need something more. I mean, that is our culture. It is designed to make you feel dissatisfied with what you currently have. I ran into an old friend a couple of months ago. It was this year. She's retired, and as we were talking, she wanted to show me some pictures of her grandkids. And so she reached in her purse, and she pulled out her cell phone, and she, you know, flipped through and found a picture and brought it up. And I looked at it, and I thought, wow, that's an iPhone 3. And I couldn't believe it. Oh, yeah, I saw the grandkids, too. She was carrying an iPhone 3G. And I thought, I didn't think those things would work anymore. You know, like I didn't think that would connect to the system at this point. Because an iPhone 3G, that's like 11 years old. And I found myself feeling sorry for her for a moment. Because if I was carrying an iPhone 3G, I think I would be feeling this urgency. Like it's time to update, you know. Like what if my calls could be clearer or something like that. You know that feeling. The feeling that there's something better and you need to have that. You know. You know how the auto manufacturers do this, how they start rolling out new features, and the car that you were really excited to buy 5 years ago suddenly seems kind of dated and antiquated. I mean, what's up? You don't have Wi-Fi in your car? What's the matter with you, you know? Our economy depends on this. Our economy depends on people becoming unsatisfied with purchases that they made eagerly just a few months or years ago. This is how the system works. We live in a culture, y'all get this, we live in a culture where it is completely normal to go shopping with no idea what you're going to buy, just for fun. That is completely natural in our culture. It's like a stress reliever, right? You're like, I don't know. There's not something that I need to buy, but I feel like I need to buy something. You know? That's just this, the feeling that we have inside. And we sometimes forget that every little thing we own owns a little piece of us. Every little thing that belongs to me, I belong to it a little bit too. We forget about that. And that's a dangerous spiritual condition. And so this morning, we're going to listen to what Jesus has to say, not just to people 2,000 years ago, not just to people who were living in the ancient Near East. We're going to listen to what Jesus has to say to people who are living in North Texas in 2018 in a marketing-saturated culture. So if you've got your Bible with you or a Bible app on your phone, I would be thrilled for you to join me. We'll be in Matthew chapter 6. If you use the table of contents in your Bible, there's a big heading right in the middle of the page probably that'll say New Testament, Matthew. You'll be the very first entry after that. We're looking for Matthew chapter 6, and the passage we're looking at begins in verse 19. And Jesus says, stop collecting treasures for your own benefit on earth, where moth and rust eat them, and where thieves break in and steal them. All right? I told you, he's talking to us. Verse 20, he says, instead, collect treasures for yourselves in heaven, where moth and rust don't eat them, and where thieves don't break in and steal them. I cannot tell you how excited my wife is that there are no moths in heaven, right? Like, this is great news for her. But he wraps this up. He says, where your treasure is, that's where your heart will be also. Now, I warned you it was going to feel like he was talking to us a little bit, you know, like kind of reading our mail, like he's meddling with us here, but we need to hear this. I try to envision, when I read a text in the Bible, especially one where somebody's talking, it's not just a narrative, I try to envision what it must have looked like what it must have felt like in that moment when Jesus spoke these words for the first time. I try to envision that moment when Jesus was talking to this crowd of people who had gathered, people that had come from even across borders because they had heard about his ability to heal. But in the inner circle, he's got his disciples, the people that are closest to him, the people that are following him and traveling with him. And in fact, these are people who are not very rich. Most of his disciples were people who had recently left blue-collar jobs and walked away so that they could follow him full-time. And now they don't have a paycheck. They don't have steady income. And so, what's Jesus talking about with this stop collecting treasures thing? Because it doesn't sound like the disciples were collecting many treasures. And it doesn't sound like being a follower of Jesus was very lucrative. I don't think Jesus was calling out the disciples for what they had. I think he was asking them to think critically about what they want. He wasn't asking them, he wasn't getting on to them, he wasn't on their case about the things that they owned. He was asking them to be careful about what they were pursuing, about which direction they were going. You see, just like all of the rest of the Sermon on the Mount, just like all of the other messages we've looked at for the last 6 weeks, Jesus is most concerned with the condition and the allegiance of your heart. And Jesus knows your heart, and Jesus knows my heart. Jesus knows the human heart, and he knows that it is so easy for our hearts to get consumed with desire to possess things that we don't yet have and with concern to protect the things that we do. He knows our hearts. He knows how easy it is for us to just get wrapped up in protecting, keeping our arms around what we have, and then looking around to see, and what can I get next? He knows our hearts that well. And here's the bottom line. In fact, the bottom line of the entire Bible. If you've never read this thing, I'm going to give you the Cliff Notes real quick, okay? The bottom line of the entire Bible, the bottom line of the Old Testament, the bottom line of the New Testament, the bottom line of everything that Jesus ever taught, the bottom line of the Sermon on the Mount can be boiled down to this. Don't let anyone or anything have a more important place in your heart than God. All right? That's the bottom line of the whole thing. Cliff's Notes there for you. Don't let anyone or anything have a more important place in your heart than God. And Jesus knows that our hearts are so vulnerable to being allegiant and excited about other things first. He knows that we are so vulnerable to getting absorbed in our stuff. And of course, the problem is that all of our stuff is temporary. Ask my parents. It was 11 months ago that their house was flooded in Hurricane Harvey. And by the time the storm passed and the waters receded enough that I could get into their neighborhood, I was down there as quick as I could to help them. But they had already had enough help from neighbors and my brothers and everybody else that could get there quicker. And by the time I got there, all of their earthly possessions were sitting out on the front lawn. And there's some of that stuff, you know, insurance is helping, and they're not in trouble. They're getting furniture and all of, you know, the things that can be replaced or being replaced. But there's a lot of things that just can't. There's a lot of things that were lost that are gone forever. And it's a striking reminder that our stuff is temporary. And so Jesus has this visionary suggestion that it would be wise to invest in things that last. You know, once in a while I see news reports or articles about how the rising ocean levels are affecting some of these tiny islands way out in the middle of the ocean. You know, places like in the South Pacific. There's some islands out there where the ocean level, just the average sea level, is just raising just a little bit every once in a while. And They say if it continues on the same trend, if it continues on the same track that it's going, that it won't be long until some of those islands are just completely swallowed up. They're underwater. Would you be interested in buying property on one of these places? I mean, wouldn't it be awesome to own an island in the South Pacific? I want to be your friend if you have one of these. But the problem is the resale value is going to be terrible, because pretty soon you're just going to have a lake in the middle of the ocean. And so Jesus has this suggestion. He says, don't invest in things that are going away. Don't invest in things that are going to get swallowed up. Don't invest in things that are going to rust and that are going to get eaten or that are going to get stolen. Don't invest in that kind of stuff. He said, invest in things that are eternal. Invest in things that last. Collect treasures for yourselves in heaven, he says, where moth and rust don't eat them and where thieves don't break in and steal them. And so the question we got to ask ourselves is, how do I do that? How do I invest my time? How do I invest my money? How do I invest my energy and my attention into things that are eternal? Jesus is helping us get our priorities straight here. He's helping us figure out what really matters. You see, in Jesus's economy, in Jesus's estimation, possessions aren't the problem. It's not the fact that you have a cell phone. It's not the fact that you have a nice shirt. It's not the fact that you have a nice car or a nice house. Possessions are not the issue here. What is the issue is the position of the possessions. Do you got it? The position that the possession takes in your heart. This is the problem that's at stake. The problem comes when the possessions become the goal and the dream and the priority. And if we find ourselves suddenly too busy with the maintenance and the accumulation of all of our stuff, and now we don't have time to do what God says is most important. We don't have time for the service. We don't have time for the relationships. We don't have time for the priorities that God wants us to prioritize because we're taking care of our stuff and getting more stuff. Then suddenly possessions have become a problem. You follow me? If we find ourselves unable to afford to give, to be generous, to share what we have, but at the same time, our lives are full of hobbies and gadgets and luxuries and upgrades, then possessions have become a problem. And we have to realize this about ourselves. Our hearts can become distracted so easily. And Jesus knows our hearts. Jesus knows our hearts well enough to know that our hearts tend to follow the money. Did you read that last verse? Where your treasure is, that's where your heart will be also. When we read that verse, we want so badly to flip it around, right? We want so badly to say, oh man, there's a typo in my Bible. That can't possibly be true, because my heart tells my money where, or my hands where to send my money. That's what we want to think. But Jesus says that's not how it works. Jesus says the reality is that we become concerned when we become invested. We become interested when our treasure is involved. When an organization gets some of our resources, suddenly we become more interested in their cause and their leadership and their practices. When we make a big purchase, we get real serious about taking care of it, right? I mean, we keep it clean. You don't drive off the car lot without calling your car insurer and making sure this thing is covered before I leave here, right? We make sure if we make a big purchase that we take care of it, because our hearts tend to follow our money. And so if you're going to be invested in God's kingdom, if you're going to be an apprentice of Jesus, then you have to lead your heart that way. You have to make the decision to lead your heart that direction. You've got to start with obedience. You have to start with generosity. You have to start with sacrifice. It's not going to happen by accident. It's not going to happen because you had good intentions. You've got to invest yourself. You've got to invest your time. You've got to invest your money. You've got to invest your energy in God's mission. And then you'll discover, after you've invested yourself, you'll discover that your heart has gotten in line with that mission too. But it's not going to be easy. There's going to be distractions in this process. And so Jesus continues his teaching. In the next few verses, we're going to jump down to verse 24, where Jesus goes on and he says, no one. All right, who? No one, right? All right, do not read this verse and think I'm the exception to this rule. All right, don't do that, because Jesus is specifically saying, nobody. He's talking to you. He's talking to me. No one, he says, can serve two masters. Either you'll hate the one and love the other, or you'll be loyal to the first one and you'll have contempt for the second one. But you cannot do it. And he specifically says, you cannot serve God and wealth. Maybe your translation says money. Maybe your translation says mammon, which is an Aramaic word for wealth. But he says, you can't do it. And that loyalty concept makes sense, right? I mean, we understand that. We understand that it's difficult to have your allegiance to two different directions. It's difficult to serve two different masters. I experienced this. I grew up in the Houston area. I've been an Astros fan my entire life. And I also was a huge fan of Nolan Ryan, because he used to be on the Astros. And so back in the day, I would root for the Astros, who were in the National League, and the Rangers, who were in the American League, and there was never a problem because neither one of them was ever going to be good enough to go to the World Series at that time, right? Okay, so they weren't going to meet. But then at some point, something weird happened, and they decided that the Astros had to move to the American League, and they were going to play each other all the time, and it was going to be this huge rivalry. And I had to pick a side, because you cannot be loyal to both. I mean, you can't cheer for the Cowboys and the Eagles, right? Like, why would anybody want to do that? You can't do that. You can't be loyal to two different masters like that. And it just doesn't work. And the secret that Jesus is revealing to us here is that God and money have opposing agendas for your life. In fact, materialism, this obsession with the things that we can have and see and touch and take home and buy and own, materialism is probably one of the biggest competitors that Christianity has in the struggle for the hearts and souls of humanity. And that makes sense. That makes sense, because materialism is talking about things that are tangible, things you can possess, things that are obvious, things that are visible. But faith is different. And the writer of the New Testament book of Hebrews tells us faith is confidence in what we hope for, and assurance about what we do not see. Faith is an investment in what's not visible. It's a commitment to what's not tangible. You can't buy it. You can't hold it. We're immersed in this culture. You and I are immersed in this culture that reinforces that false narrative that the things we own and the things we possess and hold and touch are the things that bring happiness. But Jesus is inviting us to something new. He's inviting us to a new and better narrative. He's inviting us to believe and to trust that true joy comes from partnering with God, that true happiness is found in submission to God's will and obedience to God's instruction. And I got to tell you, that doesn't sound natural. That doesn't sound like it makes sense. That doesn't sound popular. Submission to somebody else? But this is what Jesus' invitation is all about. And I challenge you. I challenge you to take a look at world history, to do a quick flyover of what you remember from the different empires and all the different nations and all of the different rulers. I challenge you to take a look at today's media. Just look at the newspaper today and ask yourself, the people who are living by a narrative that says me first, my people first, my country first, people who look like me first, the people who are living by that narrative, what's the result of that? What kind of relationships is that creating? What kind of aftermath does that leave? And then ask yourself, what if we tried something different? What if we tried a different narrative, like this one that Jesus is suggesting, that says we don't live for ourselves. We live for the sake of God and our neighbors. We live for the sake of God and one another. And I got to tell you, this is not about earning our salvation. Jesus is not given all this teaching saying, hey, you have to stop collecting treasures for yourself or I'm not going to love you. That's not what this is about. Thankfully, the incredible news that we've been celebrating together all morning is that the salvation work is already done for us. This is about living in response to our salvation. This is about living as saved people. And saved people don't live for themselves. If we're truly grateful for everything that God is and everything that God has done, if we truly believe that God deserves all the glory and deserves our loyalty, it's got to change the way that we relate to our surroundings. It's got to change the way that we use our energy and the way we spend our time and the way we invest our money. We've got to resist the natural temptation to accumulate more and more and more stuff for ourselves. We've got to resist the gravitational pull when our stuff and our wish list try to own us. And if we're going to be apprentices of Jesus, we have to embrace simplicity and generosity. There's no other way around it. If you don't hear me say anything else this morning, listen to this. Simplicity and generosity are the antidotes to greed and selfishness. Simplicity and generosity are the antidotes to the greed and selfishness that is so pervasive in our culture. Now, I know you see the greed and the selfishness, right? You're aware of that. We all want greed to go away. We all want selfishness to go away. We don't want people to be selfish. I'd just like you to stop first. I'd like you to quit being selfish first. I'd like you to be really generous. And if you're really generous, then I'll be your friend and I won't have to be selfish and then I can share with somebody else, right? But the thing is, Jesus is not talking to your neighbor right now. He's talking to you. Jesus is not talking to the person sitting next to you, wishing you would elbow them and say, hey, make sure they hear this. He's not talking to them. He's talking to you. And he's talking to me. And he's saying, listen, you can't spend your life living for just you because all of that goes away. You got to invest yourself in things that last. You got to live simply. You got to live generously. And when you do, you'll reflect the gracious and loving spirit that Jesus demonstrated for us. The invitation for us this morning is that we become people who are not so focused on accumulation, but instead people who are focused on de-accumulation. Finding ways to receive the gifts that God has given to us and pass them on to somebody else. Sometimes that looks like blessing your kids. Sometimes it looks like blessing your neighbor. Sometimes it looks like blessing a stranger. Sometimes it looks like blessing the church. The specifics of that really aren't important. The part that is important is, where's your heart? What's your heart want to do with everything that you accumulate? I know, we are such privileged people. We've got education that's better than anything in history. We've got jobs that are, unbelievably, like blessings to us and lucrative and all of that. We're in every study you could look at would say we're in the top 10% of the wealthiest people in the world. If you got here in a car today, you're in the top 7% of the wealthiest people in the world. And that's okay. God's not asking you to feel guilty about that. But what he is asking you to do is to question your own heart. What am I doing with this? How am I using this to be a blessing to others?